stories bigger than Texas, the Alamo Podcast. Battlefields across the United States are forever hallowed ground, where blood was shed in pursuit of competing visions for the future. With each conflict, the people, the reasons, the backdrops change. But the results, so many lives lost, the shifting balance of power, are the same. Today we reveal how the Battle of the Alamo and the Battle of Gettysburg were true turning points in their respective conflicts, how the written word impacted what came next, and how both battle sites are handling the modern-day struggles of growth. I'm your host, Emily Baucom. We're joined today by Jim Hessler from the Battle of Gettysburg podcast and the Alamo senior researcher and historian, Colby Lanham. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you. It's an honor and a privilege to be here.
Jim, tell us where you're calling in from and how you became a Gettysburg expert.
Well, as the name implies, I am calling in today from beautiful Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. I have been a licensed battlefield guide at Gettysburg National Military Park for about 21 years.
What's the process behind becoming a licensed battlefield guide?
We were considered to be contractors through the National Park Service, and it is an extremely difficult and rigorous examination process that contains both a written exam and then an oral examination process on the battlefield. Very difficult to pass, but we think it's important, obviously, to get the history right as the veterans of this battle intended it to be.
What made you get so into Gettysburg that you wanted to become this level of an expert?
Well, you know, my background is not history. I was a business and finance major in school, but like many history enthusiasts, I had a certain love of history dating back to childhood. And I will tell you, some of that love came from repeated television viewings of John Wayne's The Alamo when it was on TV when I was a kid.
Wow, that's such a cool crossover. I love it.
Yeah. And, you know, and I had the Alamo play set. Now, I'm a little too young for sort of the Fess Parker generation, but I had the Alamo play set. And again, we would watch the Wayne-a-mo every time it was on TV. And that was one of the things that spurred my general interest in history. So then fast forward to the 1990s, when I kind of got my first dose of reading the famous Civil War novel, The Killer Angels, and the motion picture Gettysburg. And that then spiked my interest to learn more about Gettysburg.
And Colby, you recently appeared on Jim's Gettysburg podcast to talk about the Alamo.
Jim, the content they put out on that podcast is fantastic. And he mixes it up so that his viewers get something new and fresh every once in a while and catches them off guard. And he did something on the Alamo. We met several years ago and we hit it off. His group of people are our type of people. And so it just made sense for us to be on the podcast.
You know, at first glance, it doesn't seem like the battles of the Alamo and Gettysburg have much in common, but there are some parallels. The different definitions of a struggle for freedom, the idea of that struggle splitting apart families.
You know, obviously they are iconic battles that take different places in the American cultural landscape. And Emily, I think you summarized it a little bit in the question, the different definitions of freedom, splitting families apart, and obviously the outcomes of the battles and their prospective wars had such a huge impact on the subsequent future and development of America.
We talk about splitting apart families, and that's something that people really learn when they're learning about the Civil War. And Colby, that also happened here in Texas.
Yeah, it absolutely happened at this battle and many others in our short-lived revolution. But, you know, families were torn apart, and the human sacrifice at the Alamo and other battles is massive, and it really plays a toll on the families that are left behind. A lot of women, a lot of children left behind, and those women are the ones that carried on the story, and it's the one we know today.
You also have, with both battles, competing visions for the future. Jim, what were those competing visions in Gettysburg?
You've obviously got this situation during the American Civil War where the Northern administration, President Lincoln, they are fighting to keep, first and foremost, they're fighting to keep the Union preserved. And included with that does include the abolishment of slavery. The southern states, meanwhile, have a future vision of this country where they can be independent and have their own destiny. And yes, an economy that would be slave driven. So it's two very competing different philosophies. And of course, with the American Civil War, it took nearly 4 years of blood to ultimately settle that question.
Colby, the Texas Revolution, obviously much shorter, but also that competing vision for the future with the centralization of power in Mexico City.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, the difference here, the major difference that I point toward whenever I'm talking to guests is that with the Civil War, you have an actual war. I mean, it's in the name, right? So you have a war, and normally what that means is that your governments have chosen the enemy, and they're telling you to pick up your arms and go and fight those battles. With a revolution, it's very different. You have all these different things that are playing into it, and a revolution is where the people have decided what they're going to do without the government's guidance. And so you have the Mexican government telling the army to come down, but then you have the individuals in the states within Mexico and all these people gathering their arms, and they have a vision. And so they're moving in their own separate direction. And it's really that's a big contrast between what happened at Gettysburg and what happened at the Alamo. These are people who have taken upon themselves to fight.
With each battle, there was a long lead up. At the Alamo, a 12-day siege with weeks of anticipation leading up to it. In Gettysburg, there's what's known as the Gettysburg Campaign, Jim, that lasted months.
Yeah, and it's important to remember that time-wise, Gettysburg sits more or less right smack dab in the middle of the Civil War. A lot of people come to Gettysburg with the misconception that Gettysburg represents the end of the Civil War, and it doesn't, not even close. By the summer of 1863, the war had been going on for 2 years at that point, and about 250,000 Americans, both North and South, were already dead. But yes, the Gettysburg Campaign, as you refer to it, technically begins in early June of 1863, when Army of Northern Virginia Commander Robert E. Lee decides that he is going to launch an invasion of the northern states, specifically Pennsylvania. And what he wants to do by moving into Pennsylvania is take the war out of the South for the summer. His army is badly in need of supplies, so if he can live off the northern economy for the summer, bring troops away from threatened points in the South and bring the theater of operations up into Pennsylvania. If Lee can then strike a knockout blow to the Northern Army on Northern soil, it might be enough of a political embarrassment to the Lincoln administration to negotiate a peace settlement. So you have a lot of these factors going on. And so, yes, it begins in June. The Battle of Gettysburg, of course, is then fought in early July of 1863. But the campaign itself really then continues for a few more weeks after that until Lee's Army of Northern Virginia crosses back over the Potomac River back into Virginia. The campaign is over, but then the war is going to go on for another 18 months or so.
Colby, listening to Jim, I'm reminded that the Alamo defenders may or may not have realized this, but they were buying time in the Texas Revolution.
Yeah, you know, there's a kind of a legend that the Alamo defenders knew that they were going to be there to buy time for Sam Houston's army to grow. But in a sense, what's happening is that they are inadvertently stalling, and they're allowing men to accumulate. They're allowing people in the lower part of the United States to gather up their arms. They're reading about what's happening in newspapers, and they're making way down to Texas. And so they are in essentially they're buying time.
And that idea of buying time is consistent with something we have in the Gettysburg campaign and in the Civil War in general, because if General Lee, if Robert E. Lee and the Confederate government, if they can draw this war out longer and longer, they might weaken the will and the ability of the northern population to continue the fight. So that's definitely something that both of these campaigns and both of these wars have in common.
Both battles had charismatic appeals. At the Alamo, you have the Travis Letter. At Gettysburg, of course, Lincoln's famous speech that we now know as the Gettysburg Address.
Yeah, and it's interesting because as you start to move from the actual battle itself and into what we call the memory aspects of the Civil War or any aspect of American history, Lincoln comes in November of 1863 to dedicate what is then the fledgling Soldiers National Cemetery. Thousands of dead men scattered all over Gettysburg, the area, the surrounding countryside. And the decision was made to centralized cemetery in Gettysburg rather than expecting all these parents to pay for their loved ones to be brought back home. So Lincoln realizes the opportunity here, and in November of 63, he accepts an invitation. And he's not the keynote speaker, but he accepts an invitation to attend the dedication ceremony and just deliver a few appropriate remarks. Lincoln only talks for 2 minutes, but that speech has become remembered as the Gettysburg Address, and it's one of those factors that has made Gettysburg so important in the American subconsciousness.
Many people might think that he gave the speech before the battle, but he actually gave it 5 months after.
A lot of people who come to Gettysburg, again, they've heard Lincoln has the connection here, they've heard about the address, but they don't really, most Americans, I find, don't really have a good concept of when the address occurred and why it occurred and what it was all about, even though most of us had to learn 47 years mm-hmm. ago in school. What I do find, which is interesting, and I don't know what this says, I often find that when I deal with people from foreign countries, they are more familiar with Gettysburg and the Gettysburg Address than they are with the actual battle. So we tend to focus on the Civil War and a battle. I personally find when people from other countries come to town, they're more familiar with Lincoln and the address. As I said, I don't know what that says, but it's an interesting commentary for me on how not only Gettysburg is remembered, but how it's also taught.
It certainly is. Colby, the Travis letter was written during the siege, many days before the battle. A lot of people, though, probably didn't read it until after the battle.
Yeah, that's another one of those deals that falls into kind of the legend of the Travis letter that, you know, Travis's prose in that letter, they're very strong. They're stirring. They really do draw right to the American character, as he talks about in that letter. But what people mostly think about is, well, it didn't do any good because only 32 men from Gonzales show up. So where were the reinforcements if the letter was so moving? But it's all about time and how the, you know, word of mouth, but also the written word, how it traveled back then. It actually has profound and a profound impact on the revolution, because as that letter spreads and copies are made, hundreds of them, they're spread throughout and people are moved by that. They're stirred by it enough to drop what they're doing in places like Arkansas, Louisiana, Alabama, Kentucky, Tennessee, and come down in droves. The letter spreads and there's hundreds of copies made and they're sent throughout areas in the lower part of the United States. And people come from Kentucky and Tennessee, Arkansas, all over, and they come in droves. Some of them make it for the tail end of the revolution. So we have that letter to thank for the success, some of the success that you have at San Jacinto. But then also, as we form our own national government and we become a nation, our army becomes filled with ranks of men who read that letter. And so it does have an impact.
As we've said in earlier episodes of the podcast, it's not that help didn't come from the Travis letter. It just didn't come in time.
That's right. That's exactly right.
How was each battle a turning point in their respective larger conflicts? Jim, we'll start with you.
We have this idea that Gettysburg is the turning point in the Civil War. And that is something that is still hotly debated today among Civil War historians. People, depending on what their favorite campaign is, can often make a case for why their campaign is the turning point. But at least in popular culture, Gettysburg is remembered as the Civil War's turning point. And you would ask yourself why. From a military perspective, it really is General Lee's last great move, his last great invasion of the North. He had tried in 1862. He got turned back in Maryland. He tried again in 1863. He got turned back in Pennsylvania. And when you get into 1864 and then the war's closing months in 1865, find General Lee and his army more and more on the defense. So from that point of view, and I'm emphasizing symbolically because from a military point of view, Lee's army was not broken after Gettysburg, but symbolically, we tend to remember Gettysburg today as what we call a high water mark, that this was the farthest point that the Confederacy and the Army of Northern Virginia got. And after this point, it receded back to their eventual surrender and defeat.
Colby, after the Battle of the Alamo, the Mexican Army riding high, decisive victory, the Texans' decisive loss. But it did end up being a turning point that helped flip the momentum.
Yeah, it absolutely does. I mean, the Alamo is extremely significant to the revolution. And it really is the powder keg that kind of sets everything off. You have large events like Goliad which happened afterwards, is extremely important to the cause as well. Those events and the Alamo really spur people on. I mean, there were some people at this point in the revolution who were still on the fence about where they should be, you know, putting their loyalty toward. Is it your fellow, your neighbor and your friends, your family, or is it the government that you had sworn allegiance to? But the Alamo changes all of that. It's that's kind of the end point for most people.
To Colby's point, I guess when we think about ways where these two battles are similar. And when I think of the Texas Revolution, I think of the Alamo as the battle. And of course, it wasn't. There's San Jacinto and a number of other engagements. But so many people, when they think of the Civil War, they immediately think of Gettysburg, right? And so you've got these two wars. We have these two wars that include other battles, other campaigns, other engagements. But when you think of the Texas Revolution, you think of the Alamo. And when you think of the Civil War, most people immediately, first and foremost, think of Gettysburg.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that you could almost refer to the Alamo as a high water mark. You know, for the Alamo, I mean, it is a crucial turning point for the Revolution, and it tips the scales in favor of the Texans.
Colby, during the Civil War and the time of Gettysburg, what was the situation here at the Alamo?
That is a very thoughtful question. The Alamo, of course, is in the heart of downtown San Antonio, which was one of the largest cities when the Civil War was raging in the upper part of the United States. And you would think San Antonio, this little sleepy western town, is just doing nothing. And Texas doesn't get a lot of credit for what they do during the Civil War and what happens with our economy. But this is very much a cattle town. There's beef being moved northward. There's cotton. One of the few places, and Jim can correct me, my Civil War history is a little rusty, but it's one of the few places that's still able to get a lot of cotton pushed out of its ports. But the Alamo specifically, it was the center of if you imagine like a big wagon wheel, it was the center and the main hub for all logistical things for the United States Army prior to the war. They had about 21 to 23% of the federal army here. When Texas secedes from the Union, they break away, the Confederacy picks up lockstep with that, and they double down on it. They finish building the magazine, which is the Ordnance House, where the HEB headquarters is today on South Florida Street. They rebuild some of the stables. They build officers' quarters over there where the zoo is. They build a tannery to start doing leather and leather goods for horse tack and, you know, munitions boxes. They fortify Powder House Hill, and they're using the Alamo as a headquarters for their supply depot. So there's a lot going on in our city, despite not having a huge impact on the war overall. There's a lot of things going on here.
And we have a flag on display right now in the Alamo exhibit at the Ralston Family Collection Center that showcases a lot about the start of the Civil War.
Yeah, that's a little known fact that I think would surprise a lot of people, maybe some of Jim's listeners as well, that the first shots of the American Civil War almost happened on the doorsteps of the Alamo. General Twiggs, though he's from Georgia, is left in a pretty precarious situation in February of 1861 when they'd be secessionists at that point, but future Confederates ride into Alamo Plaza and demand he surrender. And he does. It's a smart move on his part because he doesn't have very many men immediately in his area. And he signs over. The largest seizure of material in the entire American Civil War happens right here. Had he not done that, it's very likely shots would have rang out and the city of San Antonio would have been forever changed because the Union Army would never have forgotten that. And I'm sure Jim has feelings about that too, but we have the original flag that was flown over the Alamo once General Twiggs surrendered the city.
I feel like, too, I would be remiss if I didn't mention, and I'm glad Colby talked about the Army presence in San Antonio. Prior to the Civil War, several of our notable Gettysburg participants did terms of service in San Antonio. James Longstreet, if I'm not mistaken, was there for a while. But isn't there that legend that Robert E. Lee himself rode his horse through the lobby of your Menger Hotel? And they have Menger display cases. Don't they have a locket of hair or something that I think he had given to one of the Menger daughters? So,
yeah, she supposedly cut her teeth on that locket is what the thing says. That's interesting.
Now, personally, I always wondered, what is prim and proper Robert E. Lee doing riding his horse through the lobby of the hotel? I don't know if I ever quoted the rest of the story on that, but it's cool to think about that a lot of these guys that I talk about at Gettysburg did have prior connections to San Antonio and the Alamo itself.
That's especially interesting that modern day San Antonio is known as Military City USA and had that reputation going back into the 1850s.
That's right. Yeah. You know, from where Emily and I are sitting recording this podcast, you can look out the window and see St. Mark's Episcopal, which is the church that Robert E. Lee attended and supposedly was there for the basically the ground laying of the cornerstone for that church, being a very devout Christian man. And they left their mark in this city all over, really. And when, even though Texas secedes and there's complete and utter chaos, when Robert E. Lee and Albert Sidney Johnson and several others return to San Antonio and they see the chaos and how the Union soldiers are being treated, they immediately start whipping the men back into order, that these are gentlemen, they should be treated as such, give them the officers back their sabers and sidearms. And there is civility in what's happening. And you got to think about it. You know, weeks before, they were brothers in arms, and now there's a gigantic rift in our country, but they have not lost their manners, you know. And so that there's a bond as a soldier that you make, especially serving the Texas frontier, which could be a pretty terrible place.
Moving on now to modern times, both the Alamo and Gettysburg have dealt with more modern conversations. Let's start with history and memory, how that conversation has changed over time.
At Gettysburg, I sometimes refer to what others have called the Second Battle of Gettysburg and that struggle for the memory of it, which in some cases is often more interesting than the actual event itself. From the perspective of battlefield preservation, because there's a lot of ways you can take this conversation, from the perspective of battlefield preservation, which I know is so important to you, you all in San Antonio, almost immediately, some concerned local citizens began buying up core portions of the Gettysburg battlefield to try to preserve it. And that continued through the 19th century. Eventually, things were turned over to the federal government for preservation. But while that was going on, you have these concurrent, and this is probably one advantage we have, because we had a lot of survivors who could come back to monument dedications and veterans reunions and gatherings and things like that. And of course, veterans would have different perceptions of what happened during the battle and sometimes who, in their opinion, deserved more credit for it. So you've got a lot of competing things going on here. You've got the idea of trying to preserve land. You've got veterans, while they were still alive, trying to compete for prominence in the story. And then something that continues to this day, still the debate over, you know, how much of this should be under federal government control versus the rights of local landowners and local business owners. And then what responsibility do those local residents have to tell the story or contribute to telling the story in a tasteful way?
There is so much to unpack. When we talk about history and memory, the modern day conversation at both sites does have to do with the role slavery played in these battles. How do you balance that?
As I said at the outset, there's competing visions here, holding the Union together, wanting to have more of an independent destiny. But there is no doubt that slavery played a core part of the Southern economies. You know, the morality of it and all of that is also a separate conversation. But you do have to at least get across the notion that whether the common enlisted man held slaves or not, and many of them did not, whether or not that occurred, the government, the Confederate government, did have a vested interest in maintaining slavery.
And Colby, in telling the 300-year history of the Alamo, it is something that we talk about. We discussed it in our Black History Month podcast that went live on February 1st, that slavery was not a central topic of the Texas Revolution, but it was a topic.
Yeah, it was a causation. I mean, it's one of the things that's happening at the same time as the revolution that may have been a motivator for some men who are fighting. We know that. You know, I often tell people when they ask that question, I say you could rank them 1 through 15, and slavery ends up somewhere near the bottom, but it is still one of the tenets of what's happening within the revolution. With the evolution of the Alamo story and how things have changed, Texas has... we're at a disadvantage in our early history because Texas isn't settled till, you know, 1880, 1890, really. I mean, San Antonio is a very wild place. We talked about that in previous podcasts. So when you're worried about cholera pandemics in the 1850s, and you're worried about Indian depredations on local farms and ranches, and you're worried about all these other things that are impacting the populace for so long. By the time everything calms down, you start to really have time to look at something like the Alamo, they're going to focus on one big part, and that's, you know, people are still living whose ancestors died there at that time, you know, in 1903, 1905. Some of the veterans themselves are still alive. That becomes the key focus for a lot of people in the Alamo. The battle of the Alamo becomes the story for our site. And there's nothing really wrong with that, except that you're forgetting, you know, 200 plus years of history. What we get from some visitors, and I understand where they're coming from, they say that we're rewriting the story. And really what we're doing is we're simply adding to it. It's never okay to delete or rewrite history, but if you're a good historian, the historiography changes, and you need to you need to be able to adapt to that and add in new resources and new primary source material that's discovered. And really what it does is it enriches the story. It makes it holistic, and it brings it down to a level where you can look at it and say, okay, and we talked about this in another podcast, that these men were not gods. Okay, Crockett was not a god, you know, neither was Travis or Bowie. However, they were normal men like us who were in an extraordinary situation, did something extraordinary. That all kind of come full circle, and we were starting to look at the story in a new light.
Something else that Jim mentioned that I wanted to unpack in this modern day conversation of the battles, development. Jim, let's start with Gettysburg. It's a much bigger battle site than the Alamo. Can you talk about what it's like living there modern day, and if there's any issues in terms of modern day development there?
Gettysburg National Military Park, which today is somewhere north of about 6,000 acres, has more than 1,300 monuments. The Gettysburg National Military Park surrounds the town of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Now, of course, their countryside, you know, this is a campaign, 90,000 men in the Army of the Potomac, 70,000 men in the Army of Northern Virginia. This is a campaign of 160,000 men in the civilian stories and everything that was involved with that. You could make the case that almost every scrap of ground in the county or certainly around Gettysburg has some level of historic significance. And Gettysburg National Military Park preserves a good chunk of that, but there's no way that they can preserve everything. So you do have these competing interests between historians, preservationists, and the people who live here today. And I've lived here for, well, my wife and I have lived here for about 24, 25 years. We weren't originally born here, but we've lived here long enough. But you have sort of these competing notions of historians thinking, okay, every scrap of ground should be preserved in the town itself, versus the people who have to live here and say, look, I need the grocery shop.
I can't drive on a dirt road.
Exactly. I need to put gas in my car. I need to send my kids to school. What do you mean a division moved across the ground where the middle school is today? You know, I've got to send my kids to school somewhere. And you have that competing interest that still goes on. And, you know, we have great organizations like the American Battlefield Trust that will also buy land and preserve land and hand it over to the national park when they can. But you also have to realize, much like San Antonio, of course, San Antonio is a big city, Gettysburg is not, but you have to realize that Gettysburg is still a town that continued past 1863 and that people have to live in today. And it's a constant yin and yang and back and forth tug of war between those two interests. And, you know, as a resident historian, sometimes I sit on both sides of the fence that, because I can kind of see both points of view. But at the end of the day, people still need to live here. We have what is called the Cyclorama here at Gettysburg, and it is a historic 360-degree painting of Pickett's Charge. I say historic, the painting itself dates back to the 1880s. But in recent years, the Gettysburg Foundation, which is the nonprofit partner that works with the National Park Service, restored, renovated, and is redisplaying the Cyclorama painting. And if anybody hasn't been to Gettysburg to see it, I would highly encourage you to do that. It's kind of like our version of the IMAX. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
But in addition to that, yeah, we continue to renovate and rehabilitate all different parts of the battlefield and sometimes even the surrounding countryside. I should probably mention that as we're recording this right now, the National Park Service is wrapping up a major renovation of Little Round Top, which is one of our most iconic, if not our most iconic, stop on the battlefield. It was a hill that represented the left flank of the Army of the Potomac on July 2nd, 1863. For the past several months, it has been closed to the public while the National Park Service works on preserving it, protecting it, redoing some of the park, reshaping some of the sidewalks and social trails. And that should open up again for the public during summer of 2024. So you guys have all that exciting stuff going on right now with your museum and your visitor center. And while we're not to be in Gettysburg, we're working on Little Round Top and other things too.
Colby, the Spanish mission of the Alamo did its job. A city grew around it. We are now the seventh largest city in the nation.
Yeah.
But there was commercialization that started pretty much the minute the U.S. Army moved out.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to what I was saying, is that, you know, the people of San Antonio are getting their feet underneath them. It's a time where everything has started to calm down and you can actually live a pretty peaceful life in San Antonio. But that also means that commerce comes and the railroad comes and all this development starts to kind of swallow up the downtown area. And there's a big migration of immigrants that move across the river because the land is a little cheaper. And that means that the Alamo is going to be, you know, kind of enveloped by people like William Minger, William Reuter. All these men are going to buy up that land and they're going to start developing it. And the Alamo soon becomes a very tiny building in a kind of a sprawling metropolitan area. And we get a lot of questions, and I had them just at the dawn ceremony. I had someone kind of upset and wanted to know why we weren't tearing down the, you know, the Crockett Block and everything else, and you need to save the battlefield. But if we could do that, and I was able to wave a wand and say, okay, we're going to save the battlefield of the Alamo, well, technically, we're sitting on the battlefield of the Alamo two blocks away. And really, you would have to level every single building in the downtown area for about a mile around in order to recapture the actual battlefield of the Alamo, because the movements of the Mexican Army are very vast, and as well as the Texian couriers and things of that nature. So we have to be very careful on how we look at cultural landscape management. And thankfully, the field of history has started to offer classes in that to talk about, you know, urban sprawl and what happens. And I look at Gettysburg as kind of the gold standard, what they've done out there and taking down some of the buildings that were not historic. They've done a lot of great work and they got rid of a hotel. I mean, there's all these things that were on their battlefield and they've returned it very similar to what it would have been in the 1860s when the battle actually happened. The Alamo would probably never have that, but we can take what we can get and we can do our best to interpret the history. And we can't reverse the clock of time, but we can impact what we do in the future.
And if our listeners would like to learn more about the Alamo redevelopment plan, one of the pillars of which is reclaiming the original battlefield footprint, I will refer you to episode 8 of this podcast, where our executive director, Dr. Kate Rogers, discusses in detail the Alamo plan and the adaptive reuse of buildings like the Crockett Block and the Woolworth Building to become our future visitor center and museum. Meantime, both battles have had prominent roles in pop culture. The stories live on through movies and books.
First of all, in the 1970s, novelist Michael Shara wrote a novel called The Killer Angels, which is a fantastic novel. It's historic fiction. There are fictional elements embedded with sort of the overall factually accurate story. And that novel is probably, I think, our best example of Gettysburg in pop culture. It won the Pulitzer Prize, millions and millions of copies in print. But about in the early 90s, about 1993, the movie version of that released called Gettysburg. Several hours in length, Martin Sheen as Robert E. Lee, Tom Berenger as James Longstreet, Jeff Daniels as Joshua Chamberlain. And that movie has had a fantastic shelf life just in terms of introducing people to the story. The way I was introduced to your story by John Wayne, many people have been introduced to the Gettysburg story by Jeff Daniels.
The Alamo has been very fortunate. You know, Texans, we're a lot of things, but we're definitely proud. And so there's been movies, there's been television shows, there's been lots of references to the Alamo, even in the modern military. You know, if you come visit the new Rouse and Collection Center, it's just turned a year old. that we have an artifact from Camp Alamo. I mean, there were a lot of men. Clinton Romeshaw, who's a Medal of Honor recipient, you know, there's a film about him, and he talks about looking around the battlefield and sees the chaos and realizes this is the war in Afghanistan, and he says, fall back to the Alamo. Like, this is it. And so it's interesting, you know, the 2004 Alamo film sadly didn't do well in the box office. I think it barely made its money back, which is a sad thing because the film is accurate and it's fun to watch. And they cut, I mean, man, they probably cut an hour off of it. So there's all this extra really neat stuff on James Butler Bonham that'll never see the light of day. It's sad because the 2004 film being accurate is probably what made it not do so well. People don't want to know necessarily, they want the romance and they want the, you know, the
Fess Parker, the John Wayne. Yeah. It was an entry point into the history for people.
Exactly right. And so when people watch the real thing, like, what is this? You know, that's probably what the downfall was for the 2004 film. And then of course, John Wayne, plug your ears, Jim, you know, is not accurate either. And so you've got these, you got these films, and what they do well is they become part of public memory. And they, Fess Parker and John Wayne, fostered entire generations of young kids to fall in love with the story, both boys and girls. And it's one of the reasons why we have so many people who are in love with our site.
I heard it explained one time, and I apologize to whoever I'm stealing it from, but I think it's so true. You know, there might not be a, you know, one iota of factual accuracy in a movie like John Wayne's. But movies like that, or even our Gettysburg, which does have a lot of factual accuracy in it, you know, they capture the spirit of it, yeah. Right? If they capture the spirit of the place, the spirit of the event, that makes you do hopefully one of two things. It makes you want to come to that place,
yeah.
And maybe say, well, okay, that was interesting. I want to learn the real story. You know, I'm a Gettysburg guy. I'm also a Custer's Last Stand guy. I guess I have something about Last Stands, but I probably got about 40 or so Alamo books in my library, and yeah. I probably would not have acquired or purchased any of them if I had not been weaned on this terribly inaccurate but gloriously preposterous, you know, Wayne-imo movie.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. And you know, as Emily said, these are the kind of the starting points for a lot of people, gets people involved. And you said it yourself with the Gettysburg movie. But what I would say to that too is, for everyone listening, don't consume Hollywood films for your history. You know, pick up a good book like Jim's book on Sickles, you know, and you know, read those books, because that's what will set the groundwork for your historical knowledge. Use a Hollywood to fall in love with the story.
Use it as the springboard to say, oh, okay, now I want to learn more.
How did the battles of Gettysburg and the Alamo change America? And what lessons can we take away today?
You know, as we kind of said in the turning point question, the Battle of Gettysburg did not end the Civil War. And one can argue that it was not even the most decisive battle of the Civil War. But I do think it was the beginning of the end. And what Lincoln refers to as the new birth of freedom in the Gettysburg Address. But I think the campaign changed America because it was the beginning of the end of the Civil War. George Meade, who had been in command of the Northern Army for a few days, leads his team to victory, gives Robert E. Lee a beating, pushes the Army of Northern Virginia back across the Potomac River. So it's the beginning of the end for Lee's army. Although, as I said before, the war still went on.
Yeah, for the Alamo, I might get flack for it, but I really don't care. I think the Alamo is one of the most pivotal battles in American history. You know, the Alamo is a turning point for the Revolution. It spurs people on to go fight at San Jacinto, my ancestors included. And then Texas becomes a nation, and it causes, you know, it's almost 10 years as a nation, joint is annexed by the United States. It causes the Mexican War, and almost every major officer serving in the Civil War cut his teeth in that war. And so you've got all of these like dominoes that are falling because of the Alamo, and it ends up causing the Civil War. You know, Texas joined the Union, which tips the scale of slaveholding, non-slaveholding states. And so you've got all these things that kind of just fall in line. Without the Alamo, you have none of that. And it forever changes the landscape of the United States, because after the Mexican War, you know, we add half of Mexico's territory to our own. It really does. It's a chain of events that fall into place simply because of a battle that lasted no more than 90 minutes on March 6th.
Jim Hessler and Colby Lanham, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been an honor and a privilege to be here.
My pleasure.
Be sure to check out the podcast notes for this episode. We've linked to Jim's podcast called The Battle of Gettysburg Podcast. If you like what you heard today, give it a listen, especially Colby's episode on the Alamo. We've also linked to the National Park Service's website for Gettysburg in case you'd like to dive deeper into its history. You've been listening to Stories Bigger Than Texas, the Alamo Podcast.